come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I am very excited about our guest today. It is Asar Nafisi, author of the very well-known book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. And her latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is called Republic of the Imagination, America in Three Books. We're going to talk about the Republic of the Imagination. We're going to talk about imagination in general. And reading her book reminds me of a quote I encountered by Picasso. And he says, everyone's a genius until they're 7 years old, which makes sense because sometimes kids, like Art Linkletter used to say, for those of you who are old enough to remember Art Linkletter, kids say the darndest things. Kids have such an imagination. They often come up with these really brilliant quips. You only need to read Facebook and see how many mothers and fathers post what their children say. And I think that if you want to be like a child, you need to go back to that first impulse that we all had as children. It's the impulse to find a wormhole, to find some portal into another world. Do you remember when you're a kid and you look into a spoon and the spoon warps the world around you and you want to kind of climb into that spoon and check out that world that's where it's weird and everything's out of shape, or you look into a funhouse mirror, or even when you look in a regular mirror? When I was a kid, I remember looking at myself in the mirror and thinking, my God, he looks just like me. And I used to have this fantasy about climbing into the mirror and going into that world and seeing what the different Chacon was like. Maybe he was a little bit meaner. Maybe he was a little bit cooler. But I think that's what children do. We want to use our imaginations to enter into other worlds. And when we enter into other worlds, we enter into imaginary landscapes, which actually quite often turn out to be real. In fact, if you listen to the physicists, whether it's a theoretical cosmologist or a theoretical quantum physicist, they say the same thing, that there are possibly parallel universes, so many of them that if you can imagine it, it has to exist somewhere. Imagination leads to truth. And we only have to think of Einstein, who says imagination is more important than knowledge, and who imagined himself chasing after a light beam. If you were able to chase after a light beam, to move at the speed of light, it would be logical. It would be very adult. It would be very intuitive to think that the light is going to be stationary. But what he found out through imagination is one of the truths of physics, that light speed is constant no matter how fast you're going. Thus, the Gedankenen experiment. It's basically using your imagination to lead you to some sort of truth about science. Imagination can lead us to truth. And that's why I always say that if you cannot imagine a good life, if you cannot imagine happiness, if you cannot imagine you living a very productive and wonderful life, you're probably not going to do it, because if it doesn't exist in your imagination, you're not going to get there. Shirley Jackson is quoted in Asar Nafisi's new book, and she says, no live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. I think that's very insightful. Or like Evelyn Underhill, the poet turned mystic, says, reality is sharing the illusions of our neighbors. The imagination is real. The Republic of the Imagination is a real place, and we are all citizens. So let's talk to one of the imagination's greatest citizens, Asar Nafisi. Stick around. Say, Totoy. Say, Ponter. Dr. Asar Nafisi is a professor and writer from Iran who currently lives in the United States and is best known for her incredibly successful book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. I don't know if you remember seeing that book on the shelves, but it's got a beautiful cover, these young women in abaya reading Lolita. And it is translated into 32 languages. Her latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is called Republic of the Imagination, America in Three Books. We're very proud to have her on the show. Dr. Nafisi, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. It's a fantastic read. I just finished it this morning, that wonderful epilogue on Baldwin. But before we get started, can you tell us how this book is a logical next step after reading Lolita in Tehran?
It wasn't planned as a logical next step, but like certain things that are not planned, in fact, it was a logical next step. And because in between these two books, I wrote another book, my memoirs, Things I've Been Silent About. But my editor kept reminding me that in the last chapter of Reading Lolita in Tehran, I was already thinking of this book. And actually, in that last chapter, I bring the question that Saul Bellow puts to us about those who survived the ordeal of Holocaust. Will they survive the ordeal of freedom? And I was already thinking about what that ordeal of freedom means in a democracy. You know, so, and as early as 2004, I wrote an article for the Washington Post called Republic of Imagination, which dealt with the same basic themes.
Reading Lolita was an incredibly successful book, and I imagine you did a lot of lectures and a lot of readings. And you tell an anecdote about somebody in the audience who might have, if not inspired, at least contributed to this overall project of Republic of Imagination. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, that sort of incident stayed with me. I was at this great independent bookstore in Seattle called Elliott Bay, and there was a young man.
Oh, yeah, great bookstore.
Yeah, I mean, one of the perks of being a writer is going to all these amazing bookstores and libraries and talking to people like you.
And book fairs. You seem to love the imagination involved in the whole experience of the book fairs with all the talks and the booths and the food and the families and the children. I love how you compare books to children.
Well, you know, they feel like that. At least certain kinds of feelings and anxieties and joys and pains that go with conceiving a child and you know, giving birth to a child is similar to that of giving birth to a book. But there are so many connections around book. People, I call the readers intimate strangers, because people you've never met, immediately you bond with them over a favorite book.
Right, and as writers, we oftentimes, perhaps, you know, on the level of cliche, but we oftentimes refer to our books as our children. And there's this quote that I love by Borges. He says, if a writer achieves what he sets out to achieve, it's probably not worth much. And it's probably the same thing with children. If we want them to be a dentist and they turn out to be an actor, well, we better go with it.
No, you're right. And the whole amazing experience, like all deep relationships, is with both books and children, is that they always take you to places that you had never imagined existed.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we think that we teach them as we think that we are in control of our books and we write them. But the truth of the matter is that they just as much teach us. And book, you really, you know, you have an idea, you have an obsession, and you begin a book with that idea and obsession, but it is the process that tells you where you will be going, and it is a process of discovery. And I think that's what makes all the pain worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Oh, and I'm sorry I sidetracked just a bit, but you were at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, and you were talking about
that is how
your book.
Books distract us.
Exactly, we follow language here.
Yeah, and I was doing some signing, book signing, and there was this young man in the queue, and when it got to be his turn, he told me that he didn't have a book, and he was Persian. And he told me, it's useless what you're doing. It's just a waste of time, because these people, and by these people he meant Americans, don't care the way we do about books and such things. They are not like us, who copied and Xeroxed hundreds of copies of Madame Bovary or Huck Finn. And the sort of look of despair in his eyes and in his tone sort of stayed with me. And the question that was brought to my mind was, how far of what he says is true, and in fact, can a democracy survive without a democratic imagination? And so this book partly is the result of that obsession and that question.
And when you say the Republic of Imagination, you say that it is a world that runs parallel to the real one, whose occupants need no passport or documentation. Can you explain that?
Well, yes, you know, both readers and actually writers or whoever is seriously and passionately concerned with books, they come from all over the world. I talk in my books about how Iranian kids who were born and bred in Iran, who had never been to this country or to England or to France or to Turkey, they connected to all these places through reading the books. So reading, the act of reading and the act of writing, defies every single boundary, because readers come from all sorts of places, different backgrounds, different ideologies, different races, different ethnicities, different religions or no religion, you know, and that is what makes them such vehicles for freedom, because they transcend the limitations that we face in our everyday life, and we need that kind of a freedom. And that is why I call it a republic of imagination. It is a republic created of communities of readers scattered all around the world.
You know, when I was a kid, I was kind of a weird kid, you know, in the sense that I was probably alienated from other kids and spent a lot of time alone. But I was also grew up in a very oppressive time. I'm a Chicano, Mexican, and I grew up in a California that was, you know, quite frankly prejudiced, so much so that my mother didn't want us to teach us Spanish because it was the dirty language, and we would, you know, we would suffer oppression, racism if we did. And I, like a lot of weird kids, retreated into literary worlds, into books, you know, and I could enter into the Secret Garden, or I could enter into, I remember in high school, Catch 22 was a book I just spent a lot of time in. And I'm wondering if this is the act of retreating into these literary worlds, these fictional landscapes that make us citizens of this republic.
Oh, definitely. And you know, that is also one of the peculiarities of reading, because as you say, reading itself is a very private act. It is something that the amazing thing about it is that you're all alone when you read, both in your mind and heart, as well as physically. You have to sit somewhere and with a book, but at the same time, you are connected to the whole world through that private act. And there are seldom other acts, except in terms of ideas or imagination, that afford us both the public and the private at the same time. And I think that retreat from the world in order to come back to it with fresh eyes, to look at it differently, the way I usually mention Alice in Wonderland does. You know, Wonderland is nothing but a recombination of the world she encounters every day. And that is what imagination does. It refreshes our eyes so that we see ourselves and the world differently. And it is a private act.
Yeah, I've always thought of books as wormholes. You know, they are wormholes into these parallel universes. We do have to kind of submit our imagination in order to enter into them. And the other thing that we do, I think, is that because we're, in a sense, occupying the voice or the perspective of another person, of usually a character or a narrator, that I think that allows for a development of empathy for readers.
Oh, definitely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because the word empathy is nowadays so misused and abused a lot of times. We use it very shallowly. But I think in the deepest sense, we see it in what you just mentioned. We see it in stories, because first of all, as a writer, you have to put aside your prejudices and give voice to every character. So as a writer, you know, you might be a reactionary, but when you are describing a character who has opposite views, you have to give them the voice. Otherwise, you're cheating and the readers will catch you, you know, and as a reader, this is your best opportunity to go under the skin of people who are not like you and realize, and I think this is what we are missing today a lot of times in our society, in this country. Through going under the skin, you realize not how different we are, but how alike we are. As Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice would say, if you prick us, do we not bleed? You know, that we all bleed. And this applies right now to what has happened in Ferguson or in New York and the debates around it, that basically we're human with the best and the worst traits, and we need empathy in order to survive and allow other people to survive.
I'm talking to Asar Nafisi, author of Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. You mentioned the Ferguson and the Eric Garner case in New York and the decision not to indict him, the cop, for the Eric Garner murder, and despite the fact that it was, you know, recorded on video, and even conservatives seem to be outraged by this. But I suppose one of the positive things about that is it's bringing a lot of people together. We don't know yet what's going to happen, but but it certainly is bringing a lot of people together. And in essence, it's a narrative. You know, this is the narrative that we've all been following, and we're all involved in this story.
You are so, I mean, I couldn't have put it any better. It is a narrative, and these problems have existed for a long time. They're now coming to the surface. But the reason they're coming to the surface and people are reacting to it is because they finally see it as a narrative and are following it. Because what happened to Brown in Ferguson, or what is happening to, is what has been happening to many, many people. But when you put a face to it, when you put a specific case, and when you reenact that story, and when you find out that the people who have now died had a family, had a wife, had a mother, had a father, just like us, it makes a difference, and people come out. You know, now what I hope will happen will be that this conversation will not end, and we won't just be distracted by something else, because this is fundamental to change within our society. And I hope that it won't be hijacked.
Yeah, the story's not over yet, that's for sure.
No, the story, and as you know, it goes much deeper, a part of a bigger conversation which has to do with poverty and with education and with this sort of growing gap in our society between people who have and people who don't. So I think all of those are important.
Yeah, and speaking of that gap, you write about how in, you specifically mentioned the Bloomberg News website, how they transferred their book coverage to the luxury section along with, you say, yachts and wine. What does this indicate about a shifting culture or about the way we relate culturally to books?
Well, that is what, I wanted to point out, that a lot of people who are right now cutting funding for education or cutting funding for fiction or art or music in our public schools or for our libraries and museums, everything that is public is being cut. I wanted to mention to people that culture, specifically books, are always canaries in the mine, that they are sort of indicating to problems that are going within the reality in our society. And there is a distinct association between cutting funding for public schools and having the private schools thrive, and cutting funding for everything that has to do with ideas and with imagination, with curiosity and with empathy. Because a society without empathy would not think of its own survival in terms of survival of others.
And, you know, the word imagination really has the word nation within it. And I can't imagine a healthy nation without encouraging the imaginative impulse in the human being.
You're right. And then I was also raising this question in my book as well, that how could you have good citizens who can make the right choices if they don't have enough knowledge, if they're not, they have not learned how to think, how to imagine the past and reflect upon the future. Nowadays, history and fiction are so degraded in our public schools and in our system of education. How do we train people who make policy without them knowing anything about what American history, what American values, what culture was all about? And does the world respect us because we are the most powerful military nation in the world, or do they respect us because of our contributions to culture and to science? You know, it is terrible to think that a nation, you know, brags about itself as being the most powerful politically and militarily.
You write that, or you stated that the way we view fiction is how we define ourselves as a nation. I wonder what the connection is that, like you quote Jefferson saying that America boasted, or that he boasted that America was the only country whose farmers have read Homer. And I'm not quite sure farmers are still reading Homer, or even the sons and daughters of farmers. And I'm wondering if we, the way we view fiction is how we define ourselves as a nation, what does this mean that a lot of the new fiction, especially for young people, is this dystopia fiction or zombies, yeah, this really pessimistic way of seeing our future?
We have now reduced fiction either to what you mentioned about dystopian fiction, or we have reduced, which is mainly sensationalist.
Right.
You know, it has nothing to do with substance, with making our kids to think or imagine boundlessly. And one thing you talked about Hispanic culture, and one thing that really bothers me is this politically correct books that come out about other nations. and you know, my daughter always complained about it because, you know, I mean, just look at the Spanish literature. Obviously everybody knows Don Quixote, even if they don't know Don Quixote, but to Marquez and Fuentes and Lorca, and I mean, you know, I can go on forever. Infante, you know, there are so many amazing. Neruda, you know, Octavio Paz. I was brought up with these people,
wow,
you know, and that is why I began to understand these countries and love the Hispanic culture. It was through its fiction, its poetry, its music, the sensuality that spoke to me. And I read it when I was in Iran. You know, Marquez, in fact, was one of the most popular authors after the revolution in my country. So the whole thing that I'm trying to say is that is how we celebrate nations. And that is how our children grow to respect others, not by stories telling them, oh, you know, so-and-so was a lovely little Mexican boy, you know, who did this and that. Readers are not stupid. Children are not stupid. You don't need to spell it for them.
Unfortunately, you know, we're running out of time, but I have two more questions that I just have to ask. We're talking to Asar Nafisi, author of The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. And the three books you chose to muse on, ponder on, analyze America are Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis, and Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. Why these three books?
Well, I also, you mentioned that at the beginning, the epilogue, Baldwin.
Yes, James Baldwin as well.
Baldwin was very important for me. I wanted to begin with Mark Twain and end it with Baldwin because I think that Baldwin is the true progeny of both Huck Finn and Jim.
Yeah, you said you find surprising similarities between the two.
Yeah, but very quickly, I was thinking about the fact that in Europe and other countries, they have an old and ancient cultures, and America did not have that culture. So we did not have a Shakespeare or Dante or Cervantes or others. But what America had was this newness, and it needed to find a new language. So I felt that Huck Finn was, we had great authors before him, like Melville and Hawthorne, but it was Huck Finn that looked only to this new America and invented a literary Declaration of Independence, which was two characters like Huck and Jim that never never existed in literature before, a new language, a new landscape. And I wanted to show that in all these books that I have chosen and all the authors that I have chosen, they become the moral guardians of American society. And what from Huck Finn, through Babbitt, through Carson McCullers and Baldwin, and beginning with Wizard of Oz, what they all are scared of as, and see as a threat to democratic society and to America is conformity and complacency. Wow. They are all labels. They all are outcasts. Individualism for them does not mean doggy-eat-dog world, each for his own, more money, more success, and more celebrity. They all choose to be going against the conformist society, but they all connect through their heart. To someone else. Huck and Jim, Jim becomes the moral compass in that novel. And to end what I wanted to say, as I was doing this book, I realized how race had become so central to the health of American society. It had become a standard through which we gauge how the society is moving forward. And I believe that it begins with Huck Finn, this discussion that we're having today, and Baldwin today becomes for us the writer we should return to. And as he was both an activist and a writer and a witness. So I discovered a lot of amazing things through these books. But conformity is at the center of all of them, and standardization of thought, as Babbitt says.
Well, I wish we had more time. The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books by Asar Nafisi. And I just want to say one quick thing, even though I'm really running out of time. I don't usually read books on literature, probably to my imaginative detriment, perhaps. But I really love how you weave your own narrative and how we learn about you and about your friend Farah, and how really this is almost a... reads almost like a novel, because it's a story about you and how these books became so important to your next book. And thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much. I very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
I'd like to thank my guest, Asar Nafisi, for joining me on Words on a Wire. Funny thing is, I was watching Late Night with Seth Meyers when I first heard about this book. She was a guest on the show, the last guest, and he called her up to the couch and she sat. And unfortunately, he only had about 3 minutes to talk and didn't get to talk much about the book. And I thought, if I had her on my show, I would totally talk about nothing but the book. And I'm glad I got that opportunity. It's a fantastic book. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join us every week on Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read may save the Republic.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubber-necked giraffe, you look my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight.